Be seated. Good morning, and welcome to the Court of Appeals for this July 25th panel of oral arguments. We have four arguments on our calendar this morning, the first of which is Adia versus Mausau. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Musa, okay, he'll correct me. Counsel, each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel, which you can use for a rebuttal. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument, and be mindful of the timing restrictions that are indicated in the light and clock in the lectern. And in case you are unfamiliar with it, there's a button in front on the lectern that allows you to raise it or lower it to your convenience for your height. Counsel for appellant, whenever you are ready to proceed, you have the floor.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Kathleen O'Connor and I represent the appellant Tariq Musa in this appeal. The appeal is from the trial court's order denying appellant's motion for amended findings or new trial. This motion was brought following entry of judgment of dissolution of the party's marriage. I raised six issues in my brief, including correcting the value of the homestead, remanding to reassess the value of the party's business, calculation of the party's income, which I believe the trial court erroneously decided, remand for determination of spousal maintenance for appellant, which the trial court denied, reversing the court's apportionment of half of an alleged debt owed to a contractor, and merger of child support arrears, which the court denied. Brief statement of the facts is as follows. Parties were married on July 16th, 1999 in Cairo, Egypt.
Counsel, I'm just going to stop you because I think both parties laid out the underlying facts fairly well. With respect to the party's home, I'm having a hard time understanding your argument that the district court, that we should reverse on the valuation of the home, since in fact the court took the value that your client advanced at the time of the trial. Help me understand why that was wrong.
Certainly, Your Honor. The two appraisals that were obtained by the parties were done, one in February of 2020, one in September of 2020.
Which was within a year of the valuation date, right? The agreed to valuation date.
Yes, it was within a year of that agreed to valuation date of December 2019. However, those appraisals, the most recent appraisal in September of 2020 was 2.5 years before the court issued its judgment and decree. And in my mind, that makes that appraisal stale, especially when the appellant, Tariq Musa, testified at trial that he believed the homestead was worth $600,000, and then in his motion for new trial, he attached a Zillow estimate, which I concede is not admissible evidence, but it raises the question of whether or not the value of the homestead should have been reevaluated.
If it's not admissible evidence, how does it raise any issue of law?
Well, I would cite to Kitchar versus Kitchar, where there was a similar, not identical, issue in that the appellant learned of a sand and gravel pit on the party's acreage 3 weeks before the end of the trial. The appraisers had not valued it, so its value was unknown.
But how is that similar to a Zillow estimate? I mean, it's pretty much common knowledge that Zillow is not intended to be anywhere close to an accurate appraisal.
Right, and I agree, Your Honor, but it raises the question, and that's what Kitcher, the facts in Kitcher, raise the question of.
But how does Zillow raise the question in the same way that a fact that's been omitted raises a question?
It shows that Zillow is estimating the property at $611,000.
No, I understand that. I'm asking why that matters.
It matters because it's a stark difference from the most recent appraisal, which the trial court relied on, which was $392,000. And under Minnesota Statute 518.58 Subdivision 1, the court may...
What was Zillow's estimate in September of 2020?
I don't know.
Wouldn't that matter?
It would, Your Honor, but my position is that it would require a remand with new appraisals, just like as in Kitchener, determine what the value of the homestead actually is. It raises the possibility that the homestead was worth quite a bit more than the last appraisal in September of 2020, which was 2.5 years earlier.
And we have a statutory valuation date for a reason, because otherwise you could argue in all of these cases where there's a delay between the valuation date and the time of the dissolution trial. And I'm trying to understand how this case is like that, in the sense that, you know, Kitchard, there was a discovery of an income-producing asset, and I think $90,000 had already been recovered based on purchase of the sand and gravel. I mean, we don't have that situation at all. We have home values that fluctuate kind of in the ordinary course, and wouldn't saying that the district court or us determining abuse of discretion here really undermine the whole point of having valuation dates?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because of 518.58 Subdivision 1, which provides for a reassessment. If there's a significant change in value of the homestead between the time of the initial valuation and the time of final distribution.
But even under your theory, we don't know if there's a significant change in value. You're basing it on a Zillow estimate without giving us the Zillow estimate that existed in September 2020.
Correct.
So I don't understand the basis then of the assertion that there's been a significant change.
Well, there is an appraisal in September of 2020 it was $392,000 at that time, and I don't dispute that. I'm just saying with the passage of time, that value changed and increased in value. As in Kitchener, they didn't know the value of the sand and gravel pit. That's why it was remanded so that the
But when you say there's a change in value and you're basing it on a Zillow estimate at the time of the trial, but you haven't provided the Zillow estimate at the time of the appraisal that was admitted in the district court, what would be the logical basis for us to say that the district court had a clearly erroneous factual determination?
I don't think it was necessary to produce a Zillow estimate for September of 2020 because we already had an appraisal. What I'm saying is that the Zillow estimate and Mr. Moose's testimony raised the possibility that the homestead's value substantially increased, and I think that possibility required the court to at least take a look at it. I'm not saying the Zillow estimate was admissible. It just raises the possibility, just like that contract in Kitchener.
Where does that end? If you could raise the possibility of things changing, because that's the whole argument, right? That's the entire case was about both parties arguing different valuations for different things. And there's always going to be a possibility. So that's the point of the finality in choosing a valuation date and going off that valuation date.
Correct, Your Honor, but there's also a reason for 518.58 Subdivision 1, which allows for a reassessment of the value if there's an indication that there's been a substantial change in value.
But it needs to be something more that's admissible. I mean, if you came with a new appraisal, that might be a different situation, and say, here's a new appraisal that shows a fundamental difference, but it's a Zillow estimate that's not admissible, and it's just a hypothetical possibility that maybe it has increased in value.
There's also Mr. Moose's testimony at trial that he believed the homestead was worth $600,000. That's evidence, and it raises the possibility that...
Evidence based on what?
On his opinion as owner of the homestead.
And what is his opinion based on? How was the district court informed of the reliability of his opinion in contrast to the appraisals?
He just simply stated his opinion that it was worth $600,000.
And the district court didn't find his testimony credible.
Well, the district court says that. He also says that Ms. Atiyah's testimony was not credible, and yet the right, court...
So then his testimony, we don't give any deference or regard to that because it's not credible. So you take out his testimony of $600,000, we're left with an unadmissible Zillow estimate.
Well, the court didn't find all of his testimony to be not credible because he did find that he had health issues and that he was unable to work except for he imputed income based on part-time employment at 20 hours a week, $11 an hour. I mean, he didn't disregard all of his testimony, and he didn't challenge his assessment of the value of the homestead.
Was the district court required to give substantial weight to the opinion of a homeowner who didn't provide a basis for the opinion?
No, the court isn't required to do that. I'm just saying
so
that...
If the district court's not required to do it and the district court didn't do it, what would be the basis for this court on appeal to substitute our judgment about the weight of the your client's testimony?
Well, again, as in Kitchar, there was nobody knew the value of the sand and gravel pit. The appraisers didn't include it in their appraisals. Nobody produced new appraisals, and yet the court found that there was evidence of a contract which suggested it might be of some value, and that's why the trial court issued, the Court of Appeals issued an order remanding it so that there could be new appraisals and new assessments. And there's got to be a reason for the statute to allow for a reassessment at the time of final distribution.
Well, I think Kitchar provides that.
Pardon?
I think Kitchar does supply an example of how the statute applies. I'm not sure you've convinced me anyway that a Zillow estimate on the date of close to trial matters at all, especially since you didn't provide the district court with a Zillow estimate that was contemporaneous with the appraisal. I mean, if you had a Zillow estimate contemporaneous with the appraisal, at least then you would have some basis to think that Zillow has perceived an increase in value. We don't know that. Perhaps
right.
Zillow had the same valuation in September of 2020. Is that possible?
It's possible.
But is there any evidence to suggest that it didn't occur that way?
Well, at the time of trial, I didn't know that the homestead could possibly be worth $611,000, except for Mr. Moose's testimony. And then when he combined that with the Zillow estimate, it raises the possibility, and I think 518.58 comes into play. And that's the reason for enacting that statute, to allow assets to be reassessed so that the parties aren't left with an inequitable result.
What do you perceive to be the next strongest argument you have in support of your client's contention that reversal is appropriate?
Well, first of all, I did run across a case yesterday when I'm requesting permission to have it considered, and that case is Murphy versus Murphy out of the District of Columbia, and that site is 46A3rd, 1093.
Did you provide notice to the
I
court?
I just came across it yesterday.
Did you provide notice to
opposing? I did not. I'm did requesting
provide,
it now.
Did you provide notice to opposing counsel that you'd be arguing on that case?
No, I'm just requesting permission to submit it with an opportunity for Ms. Abulhassan to respond.
Well, I would encourage you to look at the rules as to how supplemental authority should be presented, and you can take that as you wish.
The district court also valued the party's business, which is a restaurant, Tony Sandwich King, using a figure submitted by Ms. Atiyah in a spreadsheet, which was admitted over my objection. It wasn't supported by any facts or evidence of any kind.
Well, that kind of seemed to me, in looking at the district court's findings, was sort of typical of both parties' approach. There's very little evidence on the value of that sandwich business. So where can you point us in the record to evidence that would establish clear error by the district court in setting that value at $27,000?
Well, first of all, the trial court did not address the factors set out in 518.58 subdivision 1 in reaching its conclusion as to value. It disregarded the requirements of Nardini that it consider several factors, the earning capacity of the business.
Well, you're talking now about division. I'm talking about the valuation of the business.
That's what I'm talking about, too. In Nardini, the court says you can value a closely held corporation by looking at various different factors, including the history of the business, the economic outlook, the earning capacity. That could have been determined from the bank statements of
Again, my question is, what specific evidence in the record, and I see your time is almost at the end, and you can certainly address this during rebuttal, but where would you point us in the record to evidence that would persuade us that there's clear error by the district court in assessing the value at $27,000?
Well, both of the parties addressed the fact that they contributed substantial sums of money to get the business up and running, and there's also the bank statements which show the business's income. The court could have looked at that and did not. It based its value on one thing, and that was a statement in a spreadsheet, and that's just not sufficient for a court to provide an accurate valuation of a business. And I see I'm out of time.
Well, you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
Is there anything here I should press to start the clock? Or
no, the clock will start when you're ready to go. We're not rushing you, so whenever you're ready to proceed, you may.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court, my name is Nahida Bulhassan. I am the attorney for the respondent, Amir Atiyah. I'm here today to argue on her behalf, and I'll ask the court to affirm the judgment and decree of February 9th, 2023, and deny the appellant in its entirety. Two things that caught my attention before I start going through the issues counsel raised by her appeal. Most of the argument are based on counsel challenging the credibility determination of the witnesses who testified in court. And we know that's not an appealable issue.
It is an appealable issue. Sometimes a witness can be so incredible in testimony that we have on occasion found it necessary to reverse if the basis for the credibility determination are such that they are not supported.
Yes, I understand, but we have case law that when the evidence is conflicting, the appellate court defers to the district court credibility determination. There is nothing severe in this case to require attacking the credibility of the witnesses. Both parties were found not credible in some areas, but the person who was found completely not credible is the appellant. And the court noted that clearly when it says that he was completely not credible with regard to the assets, debt, his health condition, earning capacity, and most importantly, most of his argument did not make any sense. He wanted the court to assess the business value based on the alleged loan he received to be the basis for the value of the business. I mean, the appellant did not provide any appraisal of the business. The court had to rely on what the respondent asserted.
Was that evidence? Can you point me or identify the evidence in the record that supports the district court's finding that the sandwich shop had a value of $27,000?
She testified it based on her experience, because they had businesses before the Sandwich King, it's three times of the property tax that they were paying, and the court found that credible. And versus his, the appellant's argument that the loan, whatever amount he put into the business, should be the value of the business. I mean, this is a restaurant business. Without my client working, there is no income. She doesn't have other employees. She works 6 days a week. She has the children helping her. It's a family business just to bring money home. And there is a huge rent amount, there are expenses. And the court took good time to go through the earning capacity of the business by going through the bank statements, comparing them with the 1099-K that she received, because all the payment goes through a credit card company. The credit card company takes a fee, and then they deposit the money weekly into the business account. This case was not an easy case because both parties use the business account for personal needs as well. And the only way the court was able to come up with the earning of from the restaurant, my client earning, was to go through the bank statement and separate business expenses, personal expenses, deduct that from the gross receipt to come up with the income. And counsel actually spent about a whole hour during trial going through the same bank statement, asking my client one by one which one was business expense, which one was personal. So the court had some good records to come up with the earning capacity of the business. As with regard to the...
Counsel, I have a question about the debt.
Yes.
And the division of that debt.
Yeah.
So the district court did not find your client's wife credible as to the debt. And then said that the only evidence she produced is unsigned invoices that didn't even indicate that the work was actually performed. But then in going forward, the court then relied on those unsigned invoices that didn't indicate that the work was performed. So is that clearly erroneous, that finding, and the reliance on invoices that the court already had found to be problematic?
No, I believe the court also relied on my client's appraisal, what it shows, workers working. She provided the appraisal, and she provided pictures of the damage in the house, and the court accepted these photos to prove that there was huge damage in the house, not only from the two incidents of the water damage, but also there was mold in the house. So the pictures clearly show that there was damage in the house. And the appraisal itself shows the difference between how the house looked before and how the house looked after. And the pictures also in the appraisal show that workers were there working while the house was being appraised. So I believe the court struggled with the invoices not being signed, but it reached a conclusion on its own that there was damage and that worth this much.
So does the appraisal show that difference in the amounts to get to the money that the debt?
No, the appraisal just shows Exhibit 20, I believe, with the appraisal show the extent of the damage in the house, and the person who appraised the property took into consideration the treatment of the mold. The total damage was 126, but the court reached its own conclusion to make it about 75,000, I mean, worth of repair. And there were other ways for the court to come up with which was credible and not credible based on the evidence presented, not only the testimony of the parties. With regard to counsel's claim of income, counsel just used that part of her brief as a kitchen sink very much through everything in it. She claimed that the appellant was deprived of having a fair trial, and he's entitled to no trial. But it, the brief or the argument does not show in what way the trial court was the ruling on determining the income of the parties was prejudicial to the appellant, because that's the standard to ask for a new trial. So the court clearly went through everything that was provided, testimony slash documents to come up with the party's income.
Counsel, one of the arguments that appellant's counsel advances is that the district court did not consider and should have the fact that the appellant has health issues that make him eligible for daily personal care assistance. And the court should have and did not consider that evidence when making a determination about his ability to work. How do you respond to that argument?
Well, we had an ongoing request for medical records. And at the beginning, yes, we know the appellant had some health issues. He went through some surgeries. We had 205 pages of his medical records, and that's Exhibit 117. I believe that page 17 and page 52 of his medical records where shows that he, after his surgery, he was treated to Target, and he was given limited ability to work. That's why the court lowered his weekly hours from 25 to 20, because before his surgery, he was doing 25 hours per week. To give the benefit of the doubt, the court even lowered the number of the hours that he could work, which was based on his medical record. There is also another factor that the judgment and decree made it clear that the appellant did not disclose all of his sources of income. There was an extensive testimony, including the appellant himself, about a business associate that he has in Egypt, which means he's a partner to some sort of a business that generates money. For this reason, we have an order for attorney's fees in this case, because over and over again, the appellant did not comply with discovery request. Another factor here, which goes straight to the spousal maintenance claim, the court declined to exercise its personal jurisdiction over the parties when it came to their foreign properties in Egypt. So the appellant walked away with 3 apartments and 2 shops paid in full. That my client didn't get any of that, plus some furniture that was $10,000. There was an extensive testimony that he went there to Egypt and took through the balcony in the middle of the night all the furniture before my client arrived 2 days or 4 days to Egypt with the children. And we have pictures showing that once she went to Coral, she was given just the use of that apartment. She found it empty. And we have pictures of the children even looking shocked that the apartment, yes, by a court order given her just for use until the children are adults. The youngest one is an adult. But she, according to Egyptian law, she can go and say, I have a marital claim. For that reason, we wanted the court to exercise personal jurisdiction to order the property sold if nobody provided the value of foreign assets or real estate. But the court declined to exercise that jurisdiction.
And you didn't appeal that issue?
No, we didn't file this appeal. We wanted a closure in this case. Right now, my client, in addition to her limited income and support to get from her mother and oldest son, she now pays monthly mortgage because the house was mortgage-free, and she had to obtain a mortgage so she could pay Mr. Musa $196,000. Less his portion of the debt, which is his fair share of the equity in the home and slash the business as well. That's the total of what he gets. So she's even deeper in financial difficulties now because of the mortgage tenant she has to pay monthly. So there is no basis for Mr. Musa to ask for spousal maintenance. He has the ability to work 20 hours. He has a lot of money to live off. And all of the argument he made about receiving personal care assistance, that was during the time of his surgeries, when he was having the surgeries and he needed care. He came to court several times, sitting for a whole day, never complained, never asked for assistance to get him up off the chair or the witness stand. None of that was in the past. And the record from his doctor clearly states he was treated to target. So, and with regard to the child support, that argument made by counsel that he was to be forgiven for the past due child support, there was no any argument made at the district court that he should be forgiven for the past due child support, which he never paid. And as we know, temporary child support orders are based on affidavits and argument of counsel, unless someone asks for an evidentiary hearing. That's straight 518.131. And any temporary order should not be prejudicial to the party, one of the parties. For that reason, the court reassessed the child support after holding an evidentiary hearing, which was a six-day trial, and determined based on the record provided to the court that Mr. Musa, for two children, has to pay $60 per month. Once there is only one child, minor child left, per the statute, he has to pay $50. Counsel did not cite any case law or statute that the court abuses discretion by not merging the temporary child support. The court didn't abuse its discretion. It relied on affidavit and argument of counsel to come up with the temporary child support. And he tried to appeal it over and over and reconsider it, and it didn't work. End of the story. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you for your argument. It doesn't appear there are any more questions from the panel. Thank you. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Abu Hassan stated that respondent testified as to the value of the business. She did not. The only evidence in the court itself says the only evidence regarding value was the statement on the spreadsheet. And there was evidence that Mr. Musa contributed $48,000 to the startup of the restaurant and that Ms. Atiya contributed $26,000, but the court rejected that testimony as not sufficient to show the value of the business. So he relied solely on the spreadsheet, which was not supported by any evidence, testimony, or documentary.
What evidence was there other than that?
That was all that there was.
So then what's the district court supposed to do when both testimony is not credible and you're left with a spreadsheet that actually shows something?
The court could have looked at the history of the business, the income of the business by looking at the bank records, could have looked at past earnings of the parties in previous restaurants. There were a number of things the court could have looked at and did not.
What by law is the court required to look at?
Well, under 518.58, the factors that are required to be considered for determining spousal maintenance are also required to be determined in valuing an asset, including needs of the parties, station, occupation, health, opportunity for future acquisition.
No, I'm talking about valuation of the business.
Those factors have to be considered.
What evidence, I'm asking you, what evidence was the court required to look at to value the business? You're saying the district court inappropriately valued the business because there were other things the court could have looked at. My question is there any requirement of law that the court put any specific weight or rely upon any particular type of evidence in valuing a business?
I think that the law does require the court to consider the factors I just mentioned. The court also is required to look at factors set forth in Nardini. And the main one...
I'm not asking about factors. I'm asking about types of evidence the court has to look at, if any, in order to value a business.
Well, bank statements, for one, would be a major piece of evidence that the court should consider in determining the value of the business.
Well, I understand what you're saying the court should have considered. What, on appeal, you're asking us to determine that the district court reached clearly erroneous findings in valuing the business. And in doing so, I'm asking you, what was the court required, if any type of evidence, what type of evidence was the court required to look at for our purposes on review?
Well, again, I can only say that the court should have looked at evidence of the business's income, evidence of the business's history, evidence of any goodwill, the party's testimony regarding the value of the business. And that sort of, there was plenty of evidence there that the court could have considered and evaluated, but chose not to.
And the case law or statute that would help us join you in concluding that the district court was required to look at these things is what? What is the case law? What is the statute that we should look to say the district court was required to look at these pieces of evidence or types of evidence that you say the court should have looked at?
Minnesota Statute Section 518.58, Subdivision 1, and Nardini versus Nardini, 414 Northwest 2nd, 184.
And what is the language in Nardini and the language in the statute that compels the district court to rely upon the types of evidence that you say the court was required to rely upon?
If I may, I'll get the statute. And
well, if you're not, if it's not off fresh on your mind since you only have 45 seconds. I didn't see anything in Nardini or anything in the statute that requires the court to look at the evidence that you're saying the court should have looked at. So
it does.
All right.
Ms. Elbi Hassan argues that Mr. Musa was treated to target regarding his health. I don't even know what that means. She just keeps saying that, treated to target. And the two pages of the medical records that she refers to are regarding surgery in March of 2021 for fusion of his neck, which was followed by a chronic infection of the spine, which remains there today. He remains unable to work. He remains on public assistance because he cannot work. He's receiving 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, home health care under a CADI waiver. The CADI waiver is only approved for persons under age 65 who require the level of care provided in a nursing home. Only they provide it at the home instead. So to say that he doesn't have any health problems, he has the ability to work, is simply wrong. And even the trial court found that he is only able to work on a limited part-time basis, which I think the evidence shows that he can't even do that. And then...
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
The matter is submitted. Thank you for your briefing and your oral argument today. We will issue our opinion within the statutory period. Thank you, and have a nice rest of your day.